Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 71 years ago today, a Spanish military in revolt against Spain's elected leftist government fired the opening salvos in the bitter and bloody Spanish Civil War. At least 500,000 died. Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, and the Roman Catholic Church all took sides. All these years later, the Vatican wants to put 498 clergy who died in the conflict on the road to sainthood. That is still a provocative act in Spain. This hour on Point, the ghosts of the Spanish Civil War and Pope Benedict's Catholic martyrs. We'll go to Spain and deep into Spanish history today. But first, joining me from New York is John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He's covered the Vatican for years and is author most recently of The Rise of Benedict XVI, the inside story of how the Pope was elected and where he will take the Catholic Church. John Allen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, John.
John Allen, this is not the first time that clergy from this bloody era have been put up for beatification, but it's Pope Benedict stepping onto this stage. What's he doing?
Well, I think there's probably two bits of context, one that is remote and another that is sort of tighter in. The remote would be that the Vatican believes that the 20th century produced more Christian martyrs than at any other point in church history. That would include Christian martyrs in majority Muslim countries. It would include victims of police states in Latin America. But the overwhelming majority would be victims of fascism and then socialism / communism. And there has been a real project to try to recover the stories of these martyrs and present them to the world as an example that holiness is not just a dusty artifact of Christian history, but it is something possible and achievable in the here and now. And so this would be another sort of bit of that effort. I think the more proximate context would probably be that there is great concern in the Vatican about Spain, particularly under its current socialist government of Prime Minister Zapatero. Mm. There have been strong church-state battles on a number of fronts, same-sex marriage, divorce, abortion, public funding of church schools, and on and on. I mean, all of the hot-button issues in the culture wars. I think there's an effort to resist secularization in Spain, not only because it is, allegedly at least, one of the Catholic strongholds in Europe, but also because it has enormous influence in Latin America. And so I think this effort to offer contemporary strong Catholic role models to Spain also needs to be seen in that context.
Now, Pope John Paul had already put clergy from this era on the path to sainthood, had he not?
Yes, that's right. In 2001, for example, he beatified a group of 233 martyrs in one fell swoop.
So, describe the process, if you would, from beatification to sainthood. How long is that?
Well, that's one of the great mysteries of Catholic life. It can be as short as a few years. In some cases, it can be centuries. But essentially, it's a three-step process. The first is there has to be evidence of a local cult, that is, devotion at the grassroots to particular people or groups of people. And if that's the case, then the Vatican will step in and they will investigate the lives of these reputedly holy people. And if they find positive reasons to believe that these were, in fact, potential saints, then they will issue what's called a decree of heroic virtue, which essentially means that they lived holy lives. Then normally the third step would be, before they can be beatified, that a miracle has to be attributed to their intercession. That is, after they died, there needs to be evidence that they performed a miracle. But in the case of a martyr, that's not necessary. If you died in what the Vatican calls odium fidei, which means in hatred of the faith, then the miracle requirement is dispensed. So basically what it means is that local authorities in Spain and then a subsequent level of review in the Vatican have decided that these were holy people worthy of immolation who died because they were Catholic.
Jack Beattie, heroic virtue on the part of the Spanish clergy in the time of the Spanish Civil War. I guess that framing is what has some hot under the collar, no doubt others very supportive in Spain.
Yes, and you know, I was looking at Ernest Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls this morning, and he actually gives a portrait of a heroic priest, and it's apparently based on a real incident, a Republican band under Pablo and Pilar.
Republican as in the ruling leftist government, yeah.
That's right. Captures a fascist village, shoots the soldiers, and then gathers the fascist civilians, 30 or 40 of them, in the town hall, where they, and then lines up outside the town hall, two lines of peasants armed with flails and pitchforks. And at the end of the line is a cliff going into the river. And one by one, Pablo puts a leading fascist out into the line, and he has to run this gauntlet, and they're beaten to death and then flung over the cliff. Well, meanwhile, he keeps a priest is saying confession. He's praying with the men inside the town hall, and Pablo keeps saying, "Who's ready now, priest? Who's ready?" And the priest won't tell him who's ready now. And finally, he just won't tell him who can go out now. And finally, the peasants, weary of waiting, and they burst in, and the scene is described by Pilar. "I saw the hall full of men flailing away with clubs and striking with flails and poking and striking and pushing and heaving against people with white wooden pitchforks that now were red and with their tines broken. And I saw the priest with his skirts tucked up scrambling over a bench, and those after him were chopping at him with the sickles and the reaping hooks. And then someone had hold of his robe, and there was another scream and another scream. And I saw two men chopping into his back with sickles while a third man held the skirt of his robe, and the priest's arms were up and he was clinging to the back of a chair. And then the chair I was standing on broke, and the drunkard and I fell to the pavement." And that's the last she sees of the priest.
John Allen, there's the very image of martyrdom. On the other hand, thousands died on all sides in the Spanish Civil War, and the Roman Catholic Church was seen as having taken the side of landlords and rightists and the man who would become the dictator, Franco. Does Pope Benedict look at the political aspect of this as well as when the Vatican's putting up the martyrs for beatification?
Well, the short answer to that question is no. Now, I mean, obviously the Church is aware of the political dimension, but I think it's important to understand that when the Church beatifies an individual, it's not a claim that everything the Church did in that historical moment was absolutely correct. It's instead a claim that this particular individual or a group of individuals, because they're martyrs, died for their Catholic faith, and that's it. It doesn't mean that the people who led the Church in that particular moment of history always made the right calls, and certainly there's a good argument to be made that the Church's historical alliance with the elites in pre-Civil War Spanish society and its essentially abdication of the working class helped create a lot of the resentment that scene in Hemingway's book communicates. But I don't think the beatification is intended to repeat that verdict of history. I think it's simply intended to say that these people who died probably had relatively little to do with the grand politics of the day and simply were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And yet the Church was in the middle of the politics in that day, and the Spanish society really broke over this. Is Spain still seen as a key Roman Catholic stronghold in Europe? How does the Vatican
absolutely
look out on it today?
Absolutely. Number one, because it is, by tradition, one of the most Catholic states in Europe, and I think there's great hesitance in the Vatican to simply throw in the towel on that. But secondly, I mean, let's look at the numbers. Two-thirds of the Catholics in the world today, there are 1.1 billion Roman Catholics in the world. Two-thirds of them, 720 million, live in the global south. And of that number, a little over 500 million live in Latin America. And Spain tends to be the point of reference for much of Latin America. I think there's a great fear that if secularization secularization, a kind of radical secularization, which the Vatican would associate in some ways with the program of Prime Minister Zapatero, takes hold in Spain, then it will spread from there to all of Latin America. So clearly, there's an enormous concern in the Vatican these days for the direction of Spain.
Let's take a call from Catholic country, Lake Charles, Louisiana. Dave, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, as a Roman Catholic, I've always been opposed to the church and its hierarchy in regards to their stand with some of these fascist regimes and stuff, that especially during the Cold War in Latin America with Father Cardenas down in Nicaragua, where the Pope John Paul turned his back on him and turned his back on the Sandinista movement and gave tacit approval to the Somoza regime just simply because it was not communist. I don't know if that has to do with John Paul being Polish or whatever, but it seems now, listening to your program, it goes back even farther. I mean, here they're wanting to canonize individuals who supported the fascist movement of Francisco Franco during the Spanish Civil War, and I've always felt that the Catholic lay people and the purpose of the Catholic Church should be closer to what Jesus stood for, which is to help the poor, which is to help the downtrodden, which is to help the politically disadvantaged. So I'm opposed to this.
Dave, we hear it. Our time is short before the break. Thank you for your call, John Allen. I've just got you for another minute. Is there a serious, significant divide within the Roman Catholic Church on a step like this beyond Spain? You hear Dave's view right there.
Well, I don't think there's much division over the question of beatification. Once again, you know, these individuals were not responsible for church politics in their time. Most of them were simply trying to defend parishes, defend Catholic schools, and happened to get in the way of the war. I think there is serious division over the issue that the caller raises, which is the church's historical relationship with regimes that were clearly unsavory, driven by its anti-communist ideology. And I think that debate certainly is still very much alive.
John Allen with the National Catholic Reporter. We usually catch up with you at the Vatican, but today in New York, it's always good speaking with you. Thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll go in a moment to Madrid. Jack Beatty is with us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire. And right now, we're joined from Orlando, Florida by George Essenwine, professor of history at the University of Florida, author of The Spanish Civil War, a Modern Tragedy. Professor Essenwine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on your show.
We just heard John Allen, who covers the Vatican so closely, saying, look, you know, these weren't the policymakers. These were priests and nuns. They were kind of bystanders to the big decisions and political pushes of that day. You're the historian. Is that accurate? Were these just, innocent bystanders to a civil war or something else, something more?
I think these are questions that are hard to answer with a simple yes or no, mainly because you have to make a distinction between the church hierarchy and the policymakers of the church in Spain, who liaisoned with the Vatican at the time, and then also the parish priests and others who carried out the day-to-day religious exercises that were necessary for their constituencies. And so when you look at that, you can see that already you've got a multiple viewpoint there. You've got the hierarchy that takes a certain, maybe even an ideological position with respect to the uprising that took place in July of 1936.
And that is the right-wing military uprising led by Franco against elected leftist Republican government.
Right. Well, Franco actually wasn't leading it at the time. He was one of several generals who and high-ranking officers who decided that it was time to change government or regime change, as we might now call it.
Yep.
Eventually, he became the leader after they decided to pick somebody who would take charge. And the church was brought into this because it lent a certain amount of moral authority to the regime that was starting to develop at this time.
So who was the church allied with then at that point in Spanish society?
Well, it was very much historically allied with the conservative order and the ruling elites for various reasons, because the church had been fused with the state since its beginnings in the 16th century and 15th century. And so you have a long association and a kind of an understanding that was reached between the governments of the day and the church, that the church was to have a privileged position in society, et cetera. And it was during the Second Republic between 1931 and 1936 that you see a more secular, liberal, so-called progressive government that tried to undermine the position of the church by, secularizing education, taking measures that would reduce the influence and power of the church in Spanish society. And so these are the kinds of things that obviously politicize the whole question in the ways in which you're indicating. And so that it was very much a contested arena there for these different groups.
When the war came then, when the Civil War came, take us down to the parish priest level. Were they active allies of the phalange of the what would be seen as fascist or nationalist troops of Franco and others? Or were they, you know, victims trying to offer mercy?
Well, they were somewhat – I wanted to point out, too, that the church itself was not monolithic in the sense that you had these divisions within the hierarchy, et cetera, but also you had different opinions within the church itself or the members of the church. Some, subscribed to a militant form of Catholicism, felt like it should be defended at all costs against the onslaught of liberalism and the materialism of the left, et cetera. And then others who felt like, you know, the real role of the church was to help the poor and to have a kind of a social reformism as part of their mandate. And so the church itself was kind of ambivalent at certain levels about how to respond to this sort of thing. Some, for many of them, it was beyond their control, and so they just got caught up in the whirlwind of circumstances. And as John Allen pointed out, they became victim or fell victim to the ravages of the early days of the military uprising and the social revolution that was unleashed in different parts of Spain, which had as its main target the church. I mean, this needs to be brought into the discussion that there was this onslaught against the Catholic Church that was pretty much unprecedented in the 20th century, that some close to 7,000 clergymen and women were slaughtered in this period of about the first 3 months of this revolution.
And what was the express reason for that?
Well, because of this long-standing enmity that existed between the church and, as I said, other
saying these were exploiters of the working class. These were the defenders of the landlord. Was it that
right? They stood
up
with
ideological?
Those groups exactly. And there were other reasons. I mean, the church had for many years a monopoly over education, which the left saw as a way of preventing them from enlightening the workers or the social classes that they were appealing to. From getting on with their, progressive revolutions. And so they felt that the church was competing with them on various levels. A cultural war obviously was there and had been going on for some years. Mm-hmm. And then also, the political alignment that the church supported the Catholic parties that were adamantly opposed to the reformist elements of the left. Mm-hmm.
Jack Beatty, this quickly spun into a much wider web of alliances. Mussolini sending 50,000 troops to help the rightists and Franco. Nazi Germany sending the Luftwaffe in, 70 years ago, something like that, this spring to bomb Guernica, the first big bombing of a civilian population. The allies and alliances were flying very thick here.
Yes, it was a dress rehearsal, as you said at the beginning, for World War II, but not for the war that began in September 1939, but for the war that began in June of 1941 when the Nazis invaded Russia. Because, yes, the Soviets supplied trainers and few men and equipment to the loyalist side, and the, as you say, the fascist powers armed Franco, but the democracy sat on the sidelines. To me, puzzlingly, and maybe Professor can say something about that, but France itself had a popular front government, but it would not aid the Republic, and the British put an arms embargo on Spain, which effectively meant that the Germans, that the fascists would get stuff there, and that nothing else could get into the Republican side. George Orwell bitterly, of course, fought in Catalonia, bitterly said that it was just as well with the British ruling class that the revolution in Spain was snuffed out and they didn't care whether it was a fascist that did it or not. But what about the politics of that of the democracy standing aside while a democracy is snuffed out in Spain, Professor?
Yes, that's frequently asked about, well, why didn't other countries step in, including the United States, it might be added, to help a democratically elected government that was under assault from its rebelling forces in the military. And the fact is that it was a very complicated political period, as we all know, the interwar years of the 1930s. When you see the rise of fascism throughout Europe and the growing menace of this aggressive policies that were being pursued by these governments. But yes, I think the key word here is anti-communism. I think that was perceived by the governments of France and of Great Britain as being the greatest threat to the security and stability of Europe at the time, given the orientation of these other right-wing governments that were coming into being. developing a deeper influence in European politics at the time. And France, the Popular Front government there, was very sympathetic under Léon Blum. He wanted to, in fact, send aid and tried to get some aid off the ground before news got out to the French public that this was happening. And it created a real uproar. The right-wing press had a heyday with this sort of information. And the society in France was so divided that Blum just said, look, we can't do this. A further reason that limited his actions was that in consultation with Great Britain, which was the real power that France had to rely on at that time, for any support should there be a diplomatic snafu or problem that would arise as a result of intervention, Britain made it clear that they would not help France should she get into trouble over this. And so France was forced in a way to adopt a policy of neutrality, which the British readily endorsed and then became kind of the main policy that was adopted by other nations looking out from outside of Spain. Although ironically I guess in a perfidious way, although Italy and Germany and the Soviet Union signed on to this non-intervention agreement that came into being in August of 1936, one of them, violated this contract by going ahead and having this kind of proxy war, as we've been talking about.
Until 1939, of course, and the leftist Republican government went down in defeat. Franco came into power and was there for many years. The bitterness lasted a long time. With his death in 1975, the way that it was kind of solved or at least tamped down was the Pacto del Olvido, the Pact of Forgetting, not truth and reconciliation, but sort of packing all this away. More recently, it has burst back out again. The Pope's move for beatification has become part of that dynamic. We want to go to Spain right now. Jack, George, Justin, Wayne, please stand by. We're joined from Madrid by a member of the Spanish Parliament, of the conservative, the Popular Party. Gustavo de Aristegui is with us. Gustavo de Aristegui, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we're looking on with interest as the Pope pushes this list of 498 priests and nuns for beatification. Is this welcome in Spain? Is it seen as a partisan issue in Spain today? How do you see it?
Well, I do want to point out very clearly that, as has been said, probably not too clearly, but I think it has been hinted that in those days in Spain, there was a center-right-wing moderate government in Spain as of October of 34 that was not respected by the extreme left-wing. And I do want to stress that that was a part of the Spanish political spectrum that was quite clearly supported by the Soviet bloc.
The revolt didn't come out of nowhere. We understand it was a complex run-up to this civil war, but what about today?
Well, yes, but I do think it's very important. You've been talking like 15 minutes about the fascist reaction to 1936 and everything, but we're not talking about the revolutionary reaction to the democratically elected center-right-wing government of 1934 that nobody speaks about today, and that was a very undemocratic reaction. It was a democratically elected government, and the left-wing forces did not accept it, and that is one of the conflicts that unfortunately led to the Civil War. And definitely, yes, there were two sides, but yes, the fascists and the Nazis supported the right-wing nationalists, but the Soviets supported the left-wing extreme left-wingers.
And we hear this is very much alive in your mind right now, and we take your point, but what about today? Your Prime Minister Zapatero wants to adopt this new so-called law of historical memory. He's opened this up again. How, and we've got, what we read, heirs of the leftist loyalists now writing obituaries today for grandfathers and mothers who died then.
It's happening very much on both sides. You see, both sides committed brutal atrocities. And this is something that we have overcome in Spain.
We have
built a very modern democracy over reconciliation, not oblivion, but forgiveness, which is completely different.
The Pact of Forgetting, it's called.
No, it's not true. It's not the Pact of Forgetting. It's the Pact of Forgiving. And that is where you have it all wrong.
Olvido is forgiving?
No, excuse me. Forgetting is not forgiving. Forgiving is not forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
And this country has built a very solid democracy on forgiving and forgiveness and not on forgetting. And this government is trying to reopen wounds of the past that had been healed by a pact of reconciliation, not of oblivion. And this is what you, where your argument actually does not meet reality.
I just have to say I've never seen it translated that way. I'm not trying to make an argument, but
excuse me, but it is pretty much the truth. I mean, this country has been ruled by a socialist government for 14 years before Mr. Aznar won the election in 1996.
Do you think this beatification will divide or unite the country? How will it hit the political scene?
I don't agree with it either. I think that both policies are completely untimely and very inopportune. I think that the Vatican should be not looking into this. Yes, these people were slaughtered and were tortured in many cases, but the atrocities came from both sides. And this is exactly what we've been talking about for all these years. And people that are truly democratic and want a solid democracy in Spain are trying to build a democracy on reconciliation. And this means that we acknowledge and admit that both sides committed atrocities. Of course, there was a brutal dictatorship that lasted for 40 years, but the central right in Spain, to which I belong, to does not feel that we are the heirs of, in any way of that fascist right-wing dictatorship. I do want to stress, for example, that two ministers, one former minister and one present minister of the socialist government, are sons of very prominent members of the Falangist movement. That is not the case of the vast overwhelming majority of the PP. So this really, what this means is that Spain has to look beyond. Spain has to look at coming together, looking at forgiveness, reconciliation, and a new life together that we built together as of the first democratic election of June of 77 onwards.
Stand by for just a moment there in Madrid. George Essenwine, how do you see it? Has Spain forgotten or forgiven when it comes to the Civil War?
Yeah, this is, seems to be a tricky phrase here. I think what my understanding of this pacto was that basically the during the transition, especially in the late 70s and early 80s, was that most politicians would not try to dig up the skeletons of the past and try to assign blame to one side or the other in excess. In other words, depoliticize the past as much as possible. And so they didn't deal with those very fiery or inflammatory issues until recently. I think in the last year or two, there have been a public debate in Spain over this whole question of when did the Civil War begin? And the party member from the Alianza Popular has pointed out that this was...
I'm from the Popular Party, and I come from the liberal wing.
I'm sorry.
We are the merger of three different movements, as you know, the liberals, the Christian Democrats, and the conservatives. And I am actually a liberal.
I'm sorry. My mistake.
So
yeah, sorry. But in any case, some members of the society have argued that 1934 was the real origin of the Spanish Civil War because it showed a determination to overthrow the legally elected government at that point, and 36 was just a follow-up from that. Others have argued that this is trying to legitimate the rights case for Franco and his long dictatorship, et cetera. And so it's really become very muddled now over a lot of these historical issues.
I do want to stress what you're saying.
Yes, please.
Because as of 1934 onwards, the moderate right of Spain was targeted by the extreme left wing, pro-Soviet bloc. Republic.
We heard that point. Is this whole fight coming back now?
I do want to point out that during the Franco years, the moderate right was even more persecuted than the left wing. I mean, Christian Democrats and liberals were either jailed or ostracized, and most of those and their descendants, ideological descendants, are today's members of the main opposition party of Spain.
Gustavo de Aristegui, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's roll the tape forward just a little bit from the end of that war in 1939 with the victory of Generalissimo Franco. Hear from a newsreel that played in American movie theaters in 1957 on the 18th anniversary of Franco's victory. Well, you'll hear. They're celebrating kind of an anniversary of the dictator.
Spain celebrates the 18th anniversary of the termination of the Spanish Revolution and victory over communism. The nation's military might, much of it of American manufacture, acquired in return for bases, is on display for the occasion. Senora Franco and her daughter are among the distinguished guests, as is the Generalissimo himself. One of the colorful contingents is made up of the Moorish guards. As a crack unit of paratroopers passes in review, the Cordillo looks on with pride. 18 years of peace and rebuilding.
Amazing, and no doubt how the U.S. media saw it in 1957, Jack. The Cordillo looks on with pride.
Yeah, and I remember people who told me stories of going to Spain in the 50s, and you could go to these villages, and you could look at the wall outside the village, pockmarked with bullet holes where the Franco people had their firing squads. And if you'd start to talk to anybody about the war, you know, it would be silence, nothing. I mean, people were terrified of speaking because of the great weight that it still had. And, you know, Franco's survival is a kind of marvel when you think of it. I mean, here's a war against fascism destroyed in 1945, and this guy sails through the war in neutral, and then in the Cold War is embraced
hero.
as a tribune of anti-communism.
Of course, a lot of killing, as you read earlier, on both sides. Let's go to our listeners on the issue of beatification. Brian's calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that it would be quite a distortion of Benedict's action to interpret what he's doing as either support for some sort of restoration or even retroactive support for the kind of regime that was in place. It was really more for witness to the faith that Benedict is in charge of rather than witness to fascism or witness to totalitarianism. And really at the same time, it shouldn't even be construed as support for fascism either. It's really the support of the faith. And at the same time, the regime that perpetrated the atrocities on the Catholic Church really had declared war against it in its most pure and unadulterated form of communism, sort of an atheistic form of communism, where there would be a complete abolition of the church.
So do you say bring on the beatification, Brian? Do you think the canonization should proceed here?
I think that for the predicate that it's a witness for the faith, not a witness for fascism, not a witness for Franco, not a witness for totalitarianism, but a witness for the Catholic faith. There's sort of a third interest in this. Sure, there was a temporal political struggle between right and left caught in the middle of this, but perhaps sort of having more of a common interest or a traditional alignment with the
right. Sainthood for faith, not fascism, and we've got that. Let me get a couple more calls. Thank you, Brian. Robert is calling from Boston. Robert, what do you see?
Hi, thanks for having me on. Yeah. I just want to say, someone myself who's lived in Latin America and Spain just recently, I've notice that, like, there's this huge idea. I don't have to comment first on the thought that, like, he's doing this to appease and try to make growth of Catholic Church in one of these areas. There's a belief that there's fascism, the Catholic Church, and even, like, Nazism, like, are always, like, one entity, and that people want to rebel against that.
Who believes that, Brian? What are you saying, Robert?
Oh, I see it in graffiti all across Spain. The friends that I had, the teachers I had, everyone. That was the culture, at least in the villages I lived in.
Kind of an anti-clerical culture.
Yes, very. And also a very anti-right. Like, they see, like, Bush as in the same category. I don't believe this is correct, but this is just the culture of them. And they see Pope Benedict as also in this category. And how they see this as a rise of fascism again. And I don't see how Pope Benedict giving... I'm not Catholic, so I don't believe I should comment on whether he should give sainthood to these people or not.
Mm-hmm. Let me get another call from Randy in Burlington, Vermont. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi. I actually lived in Spain about 20 years ago. I went there the first time in 84 and then lived there in 88 and talked with a lot of older people and have read a lot of history on both the Civil War and on Franco. And a lot of the people there still in 88 didn't trust the clergy and they didn't go to church because basically the clergy after Franco, which the terror went on much longer than during the Civil War. It went on for almost 15 years after the end of the Civil War, and people didn't trust the clergy because the clergy basically would turn them in if they didn't go to church or if they said something, or in Valencia, if they spoke Valenciano or Catalan, they were taken away.
And what about canonization now? Do you think it will help? A good thing? How do you see it?
I agreed with the minister, the Spanish minister you had on. Mm-hmm. It's going to tear. It's going to bring up old wounds. You know, people there, they don't want something like this. It's a real misconception that people, they say that Spain is the most Catholic of countries. Actually, I think France has the only lower rate of people going to church. Hardly anybody went to church when I lived in Spain, mostly just old women. And
so it's a mixed picture, and we've got that. Randy, let me get one more call here from Charleston, South Carolina. Gonzalo, you're on the air.
Yes, this is a great issue. I'm from Spain. I've been 10 years living outside Spain.
Yes.
And just to make a long story short, I don't think this is going to help in Spain. It's going to open a lot of closed wounds. The socialist government now in power with this so-called historic memory law is not helping to keep those wounds closed. Back in the late 70s, when Spain was able to bring democracy, there was a general understanding that the Civil War had to be kept back in history. We need to remember that at that time, Presidente Suarez made a very bold move, and he sat down and talked to the head of the Communist Party. He legalized the Communist Party, even though at that time, there were more than rumors that even the head of the Communist Party, back when he was a young guy, he participated directly in shooting down a lot of people. So again, to make a long story short, as I was saying, this is not going to help. The Spanish democracy has come through a long, long and winding road, and this is not going to help. And last but not least, I see this move from the Vatican as an attempt to try to revive what Karol Wojtyla, the former pope, did with communism. I think he played the key role in bringing down the Iron Curtain. But now I think this move has nothing to do with looking ahead into the future.
Gonzalo, we appreciate your perspective, and thank you very much for calling in with it. Okay, Jack and George Essenwine, there are many perspectives on the table. George, let me go to you first with our caller Brian in Connecticut. Says this is about faith, not fascism, and let's see it that way. They bore witness to their faith, and they deserve the Vatican's imprimatur. I won't ask you to adjudicate, you know, the Vatican's move on this or the Pope's, but what about it? It was about faith, not fascism. What went on there?
Yes, I think even John Allen mentioned this in his interview earlier, is that there really are two separate questions here. One is a religious one, which relates to, you know, the whole process of beatification and recognizing people in your faith. And another has to do with the historical circumstances in which which involved the Catholic Church during the Civil War period. And I think in Spain, why this resonates so much as it has been doing in Spain is because it is intertwined with the political and social issues there that have been part of that country for many years. And so if you can take out the religious question and that religious act, then you could say, yes, there's no reason why you shouldn't honor people or consecrate people in your faith who have shown a certain characteristics that are worthy of that sort of, anointment. But in Spain, that's not going to happen because, again, the church was never fully separated from these political events. And even though there were priests and others who tried to remain neutral, in the end, they couldn't be. And just as that one caller, another caller said, I mean, these things, even today, you see a mixing or lumping together of different groups. We've even mentioned, by the way, I should interject here, too, that the word communism is always used. In fact, the onslaught against the Catholic Church during the Civil War was spearheaded by the anarchists, who were very much against the communists. And the communists tended to be against these sorts of violent acts. and played a much more moderate and conservative role during the Spanish Civil War, ironically. And so we keep calling them communists or the communists. I mean, the communists weren't really that important until the war got going. And again, they took a very anti-revolutionary line. They were the ones that George Orwell opposed because they were against the revolutionary left, the groups he supported. And so we need to be clear here about these groups. And that I mention this because this typifies the problem here is that we tend to, in the discussion of these issues of the past, group together all kinds of disparate elements.
Right. But we're hearing more and more texture here. And it's great to get. I mean, it gets boiled down, you know. Of course, I mean, the great image of Robert Capa, the Spanish Republican soldier falling in battle, and the story behind that can get very hyper-simplified. But one thing we're hearing again and again, sort of surprisingly, I think, to an outsider in this hour, is that the sense that there is still a vulnerability in this democracy to this old wound, George S. Wine. Do you feel that? Do you see that?
Yes, I think insofar as the legislation we've been referring to of the historical memory was really intended to kind of identify the victims on both sides. But it didn't stop at the Civil War. It went, as one of the callers said, it went beyond the Civil War into the period of repression when Franco was establishing his regime or consolidating his power. And so what the intent was is to let's name all and the victims here on both sides. But that whole process has become more so politicized that the legislation has stalled and it probably won't get passed because it's seen not as that, as saying let's establish some neutral ground here on which we can both stand, but rather let's make a definitive judgment about the outcome of that Spanish Civil War. And so this sort of thing is not going to go away because the atrocities are the kinds of scars that never die out completely. And also because the historical memory is such that it's easily manipulated by politicians in ways that will play out in the different arenas that we've seen now in Spain. And so I think it's not the case that you can say, well, that was in the past and let's move on to the future here, because in Spain, as I said, it's still pretty much insinuated into the entire political process and will continue to be so until such time that there's no real living link to that event.
And of course, it's hard to make it a balanced movement here. Franco, for example, I'm reading here a story from this spring in the Sunday Times of London out of Malaga, where the remains of thousands of nationalist supporters had years ago been exhumed and reburied in an elegant crypt in the city's cathedral. The Republican loyalists to the leftist government, 3,600 lined up against a cemetery wall, shot and killed, buried in trenches they had just been forced to dig themselves and had not been exhumed until now. So different things come to light. Let's take a call from Bob in Lexington, Massachusetts. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. First of all, you know, in 1931, when the Republic, which was not a communist government, took over until the revolution started, there was no killing of priests. There was no devastation going on. It was only after Franco came in and started the war that all these things took place. Secondly, the reason the Americans and the English and the French didn't go in because the French and the English didn't go after Hitler until he invaded Poland. And the Americans didn't come in until after the Pearl Harbor. And thirdly, if the Pope is going to beatify priests, how about those priests, say, in the Basque Country who were shot by the Franco forces, who are also protecting their flock, because the Basque, except for Navarro, was opposed to the Franco regime. Why aren't they being beautified?
How about the priests who weren't on Franco's side there? How about the priests who weren't on Franco's side, you're asking there?
Well, they were killed, and so were another priest. As far as I'm concerned, the ambassador from Spain was right. The Pope should stay out of this completely.
Bob, thanks very much for your call. Jack Beatty, history is long, but it does not go away.
No, the past isn't past. I mean, our politics was hostage, really, for 50 years to the Civil War. That was the main dividing line in American politics.
You mean
politics.
The American Civil War?
Absolutely. And the passions didn't die away, and the cry of, you know, wave the bloody shirt in the North, and in the South, the gray cause. These things rallied people right into the 20th century, and and Spain is no exception. I began with Hemingway. He has a peasant, Anselmo, reflect on all the killing, and he said, in Spain it is done too lightly and often without true necessity, and there is much quick injustice which afterwards can never be repaired.
Joel Justin-Wine, well, it's a complex picture, and we appreciate the subtlety that you bring to it. The Vatican seems to have this on the rails and moving ahead. I don't know, if people look back in another 30, 40 years, do you think this will be seen as a step toward reconciliation somehow, or a reopening of trouble?
I think they're going to have to lay it to the side and, as I said, treat it as a separate issue, saying, well, this is what the Catholic Church wants to do in the 21st century, but has nothing to do with the Spanish Civil War or with our contemporary world, because it's their act and not ours.
Hard to hold that line, but it may be the one. Joel Justin-Wine, author of The Spanish Civil War, A Modern Tragedy, professor of history at the University of Florida, joining us today from Orlando. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
Jack, wonderful to have you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.